We're going to get going here. It's 3:15. We start on the dot here. We want to try to get as much information to you as we can. This is how to move and enhance existing applications for Windows Azure. First thing I'd like to do is just get a feel for, it's tech ed, so we see a lot of different roles in the room. How many of you would say you spend most of your time developing in front of Visual Studio? And how many would say you're more on the operational side? Okay. So we've got a little bit of both. That's sort of typical with tech ed. This content is great because I think you're going to see a little bit for everybody. My name's Tom Fuller. We've got Purush Bankaretti over here. We've got Greg Barberis. We're in the field and services engineering teams. And this session, you know, you've been hearing, hopefully as you've been to tech ed, you've seen a couple of different sessions on infrastructure as a service. And we're lucky you've been looking at platform as a service for a while now. It's been out for a couple of years. It's going to be kind of interesting now as we have infrastructure as a service released out in the public. What does this look like for everyone as they start to migrate their applications, you know, into the public cloud? Also, you probably hear the cloud used for private cloud computing as well, right? So where does that fit in? So as we started to think about sessions to bring to tech ed, we looked at how could we just give everyone some maps, right? So sort of like an atlas of how to get your applications into the cloud. And this kind of theme started to develop where you've got infrastructure as a service, you've got platform as a service, you've got hybrid, which is a combination of all sorts of things, potentially. You've got private cloud, you've got networking capabilities that are new. And really what we want to do is want to boil that down some and look at what we would consider sort of a good way to get going into cloud computing, a better way to get going, and what we still perceive as the best way. And as we transition through the three of us here, you're going to see three different models of how to deploy existing types of applications in what we would consider sort of a good, better, and best. And really those concepts are about making it easier for you to manage the applications, right? So we'll look at a hybrid success story where we've actually done this with a real world application. We think you're going to find it a pretty well-known application when we show you what it is. And we'll try to give you some pragmatic plan for moving into PaaS. Right. For a couple years now, we've said, just get your app to PaaS, just get your app to PaaS, just get your app to PaaS. So it's been sort of akin to trying to understand how to develop plugins for SharePoint, which if anybody's done a lot of that, you know, it takes a little bit of know-how, takes a little bit of understanding of the platform as it exists. Right. So the platform as a service story continues to be there, and we'll talk a little bit about that at the end. So I'm Tom Fuller. As I said, I'm a field engineer focusing on the developer technologies with different customers. And let's just give you a quick rundown of how we got here on the cloud a little bit. I mentioned that, you know, we're all in. When it came back to University of Washington, Steve Ballmer talking about the cloud, he said this is a big bet for the company. So the cadence on this has gotten really incredibly fast ever since that announcement. And the field and services engineering team has reacted accordingly. Early on, it was really still evolving. And the main thing I want to show you is how we went from this idea of platform as a service being a very controlled environment by us at Microsoft. And then things like the SDK 1.3 came out, which gave you RDP access into your platform as a service instances. Some people don't even know that. I mean, a lot of people think you have to be dealing with VMs to get RDP access. The platform as a service environment allows you to have RDP access as well. The VM role and Azure Connect beta products came out, which gave you even more control over the OS servicing. Not everybody was thrilled with the idea of us rolling out patches on you. Not sure why. People like control, like to test things, I guess. Har, 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 har. And then we get really mobilized in the field at this point. We spend a little time understanding it, and then we get mobilized. We actually built training materials. In fact, we've got some new stuff that's going to come out here in the next couple months. That if you're interested, we're looking for folks that want to beta test it. It's how to troubleshoot solutions. We've got four labs you can download and do on your own time. So if you're interested, come up and talk to us later. But then as we really started to understand how to work with PaaS, the service engineering team wanted to partner with us and work on getting MSDN and TechNet working in the cloud. MSDN and TechNet, as Purush is going to cover, is it's not a Hello World app. Right? That's the real deal. And we'll talk about the volumes of things they have to consider, the data footprint stamp that they've got to deal with, and we started to kind of understand where platform as a service had some challenges. SDK 1.6 comes out, and that changes things a little bit. We have to adapt some of our content. But then where things have gotten really interesting is since the beginning of this year, we've partnered with our technical evangelist folks, and we're doing very early previews of the infrastructure as a service stuff that you're just seeing publicly this week. And we started to bring that knowledge back to this MSDN TechNet migration. So the cool thing is, this should sort of set it up as to how we can kind of give you an overview of the three different models, because we've sort of felt it. What we also recognized going through this is that managed public clouds isn't necessarily the only way in which everybody wants to get into cloud computing, right? There's going to be some obvious blockers that maybe you've all felt. The first one, and we recognize this isn't going to go away anytime soon, is that there's specialized hardware with hardware security modules, high tier one workloads that need ultra performant I/O. Those things aren't necessarily going to work well inside of something that has a lot of layers of fabric control around it, right? So even as we talk about infrastructure as a service, there is still a certain layer of overhead associated with it. So, I mean, we're talking a large percentage of your workloads are going to work fine, but bare metal is still going to be there, right? So this is our appreciation of the fact that the data centers aren't going to all live in either ours or other vendors like Amazon's and things like that. Private virtualized. So this, I think, the biggest one is compliance and data security. I've been downstairs listening to a lot of questions from customers, and there's still a lot of anxiety about giving the data and putting it in someone else's data center. I mean, that's from looking around the room, I'm not seeing a lot of nodding of heads, but I'm assuming maybe in the back of your mind you're feeling like that. It's still an option to look at private cloud computing, and I'll talk about what private clouds are very briefly. I will say that this session exclusively is covering public cloud computing. And last but not least, we actually think there's a lot of niche demand that drives hybrid implementations. Thinking about cloud computing scenarios, like somebody asked me today, you know, how can I get somebody excited about us moving to the cloud? Well, do you have any Elastic scenarios? Elastic scenarios fit really, really well, because we're talking about the rent versus own condition here, where we can actually just use the infrastructure as we need it to satisfy some type of a workload and then give it away, give it back, right? Just use it, rent it for 2 days, get the results that you need and give it back. You didn't have to go purchase all that hardware, rack it up, and, you know, figure out how to leverage it after you no longer need it and it's running at 2% CPU on average, right? So that's the big thing, is understanding where those hybrid scenarios fit. Continuity and recovery is a big one, right? Leveraging it so you have an external data center, so DR. And then increasing your reach, because not everyone has multiple data centers all over the globe, right? We do, and other vendors do as well. Private cloud, real quick. Just want to make sure to provide some clarity here, because we are talking about all those things that are cloud-oriented here in this talk. And private cloud is really about you having your server infrastructure set up in such a way that it's basically abstracted to this concept of compute and can provide a certain level of self-servicing, right? So it's not just about VMs. It's about VMs and self-servicing in our product, System Center, and, you know, Windows Server and Hyper-V and Virtual Machine Manager. They deliver on that story. And that's it, I will tell you. I'm not going to talk any more about private cloud computing. It's really not a focus of the rest of this talk. Okay. That's kind of all kind of high-level cloud computing stuff. Now let's work our way into applications themselves. So actual on-premise applications, the ones you guys have been building, coding. I've been doing it for 15 years plus. I've written a number of different ones. And what do these applications tend to have, right? What is it that folks, as they're looking at platform as a service, kept finding it to be relatively challenging to just take an application and move it right there? Well, a lot of times they come with certain dependencies, right? Things like COM+, things like the distributed transaction coordinator. I know I'm guilty of taking for granted the Windows auth infrastructure, right? Somebody's logged onto their machine, they're able to authenticate to the application, and it just works, right? Those are certain elements that you don't necessarily have an automatic, you know, setup routine as you go into certain elements of platform as a service. And the other thing is they're somewhat complicated. If you are just now getting exposed to Windows Azure, the platform as a service model, you maybe didn't have to deal with some of the legacy of we had a 50 gigabyte constraint on the SQL SQL database. I guess at that time it was SQL Azure, so I'm clear saying it that way. The SQL database that was in the cloud had a 50 gigabyte limit. A lot of applications that use more than 50 gigabytes. I had a lot of conversations with various customers that said, how can that be that the only option for scale is scale out? Right? You have to have designed your application to think that every database could never be larger than 50 gigabytes. I mean, we're up to 150 gigabytes now in platform as a service, but this was an example where existing apps just weren't really aware or able to handle those things. You've also got the fact that there's knowledge leak issues with apps that were written 10 years ago. Right? I mean, sometimes devs tend to move from company to company. It happens. And when they leave, sometimes the knowledge of what that app is leaves with them, right? So being able to go in and pull apart that application and clean it up or fix it or do whatever you have to do to get it running in platform as a service has been a bit of a challenge. The scaling architecture is the last one I'll mention. For a long time, and I'm guilty of it as well, I didn't think too much about scaling because I thought we could just keep adding RAM and CPUs until Moore's Law would never end, right? Those kind of things, at least 10, 15 years ago. It certainly, definitely did. So we're kind of at a ceiling at this point where you need to be prepared to scale out, not up. And a lot of the designs for the applications aren't built that way. And things like our platform as a service offering really hope that you have that stateless design in mind, right out of the box. Through the rest of this talk, we'll talk about three types of applications. Hopefully everyone in the room sees these three and goes, yeah, I got one of those, right? Yeah, I could think of a scenario where that'd be interesting. The first one is a geo-distributed service, and the points that you see below here are really what help us get to the point that it's a interesting cloud computing scenario. One, it's not really bound by any specific compliance regulation issues. Those are still things that are continuing to evolve. And it is actually, in this case, dependent on a certain server infrastructure. In our case, we're going to talk about the distributed transaction coordinator, something that until infrastructure as a service existed, there was no way to deploy an app that depended upon that in the Windows cloud, or Windows Azure public cloud. And then the usage patterns map well to the cloud because of the geo-distributed nature. There's our MSDN TechNet logo. So I mean, probably a lot of you have public-facing websites. Maybe you have public-facing websites that have high storage demands, right? They store maybe hundreds of gigabytes of data, or in our case, terabytes of data, right? There's lots of data from MSDN. If you're going out there, you probably use that site enough to know it's got a pretty expansive collection of content, right? And the performance is a key, and sometimes there's huge elasticity demands. And Purush will go into more detail on that, but the usage patterns potentially are all over the place, which maps it really well to us doing it in the cloud. And then last but not least is our intranet line of business applications. All right, everyone's probably got a catalog of these that are running that 10 users are using on-prem, and maybe at some point you're dealing with the fact that it's running on old hardware and the warranty's about to expire, and gee, wouldn't it be great if I just didn't have to run this thing in my data center anymore. Right, so there's some of those scenarios as well that we'll talk about. So each one of these application architectures we're going to cover in the next pieces of this talk. Okay? Here's a little bit of a diagram to try to showcase this first one. So we built an application service, an inventory service. Maybe it's something that you've got a nice little shop that's using this inventory service out of Chicago. It's been running great. And you made a great investment in the stock market and decided you're going to expand a little bit. And you open up a storefront in Los Angeles, but you don't have a data center in Los Angeles, right? Everything's centralized in Chicago. So you said, we'll be fine. We'll just deal with it. It probably isn't going to be too slow. We'll do some async threading somewhere and put a little wait marker on the page and no one will notice. And then you get another one in Orlando, and now things are getting interesting. Everybody's trying to kind of get to the centralized environment. Behind the scenes, as these applications were built, the scale model was built to have multiple databases. One is the branch inventory database. Another is the central inventory database. And it's committed through an actual atomic transaction to make sure that everything's in sync back in the central repository. For BI purposes, let's just say that's what you came up with because it was a low friction way to add new branches as they came online. So you actually had the vision in mind that you might want to expand it. What's the problem with this? The big problem is we've got some latency to deal with because the data center is all centralized, the users are distributed, your code is nowhere near your users. So we've got this problem. How do we solve this problem? Well, this is where just generally cloud computing can be very, very useful for you. We've got a US West and a US East data center. We could take this application architecture stamp, we can run it in both of those data centers. So now, our users are able to hit the applications as close to them as we possibly can. But we've got one thing that could potentially be a problem here. We've got a central inventory database that's no longer central, right? So how do we fix that? Well, SQL Data Sync's pretty good at this. SQL Azure databases, up in the cloud, being able to do two-way synchronization, that's gonna be fine. So we solved that problem. But we got blocked. Hardcore on trying to get into platform as a service here because the application architecture as it stands today doesn't allow me to actually run anything with the distributed transaction coordinator. So, bummer. I guess I have to go to Amazon. No, not true. Right now, we actually can run these VMs inside of Windows Azure with infrastructure as a service. So, we like this concept called forklifting because it, in your mind, hopefully, it just sounds like picking something up, putting it in there, and not really touching what's on the pallet. Right, so your application's on the pallet, you're picking it up, and you're just putting it into infrastructure as a service, and you're not touching it. Yes, I mean, I certainly could say if the devs in the room are looking at that architecture, they're going, why not just combine the databases? That's ridiculous. I don't want to touch the application. I don't want to deal with it. Also, there's going to be other scenarios where you've got multiple resource managers, and DTC's not going away. So what are some of the triggers? We saw one there, the usage pattern's changing. The users are distributed some. Maybe the hardware is refreshing, and I kind of covered this a little bit already. The capacity in your data center is exceeded. So let's just look at the public cloud to solve these things when I can get past some of the limitations. And the last one on that trigger list is not so much a cloud computing trigger, but it's a trigger between moving to infrastructure as a service versus moving to platform as a service. And in this case, and this is going to be the case in all the various vendors for cloud computing, there's not 100% fidelity with the feature set. Right. So in this case, we're missing a feature, DTC. We don't have a way to deal with two-phase commit distributed transactions in the platform. So you have to go back to, you have to down-level to infrastructure as a service. Another thing with forklifting that is very attractive, and we want to make sure to mention it, is that you can move non-sensitive components directly up into Windows Azure and set up connectivity back to your own on-premise data center. If you haven't seen some of the stuff for site-to-site networking that we announced, leveraging your own Cisco and Juniper routers. If you're doing branch networking today, or if you're doing any kind of retail front ends that are connecting over those VPNs, there's a laundry list of supported hardware that you can go and extend your data center into the public cloud. So that's really great on the privacy side, right? Because now I can just let my data live where it lives, and I'm not worried about it living up in a data center that somebody else is managing or who's touching the data, and is it done to the level of encryptions we need it to be done to, right? You can control it the way you want to control it. So you've got a lot of options. VM mobility, I know that's got a bit of an overloaded context. It's not about live migrations. I really mean portability. The ability to actually take a VHD, be working with it in your own private cloud, have a VHD, and then move it up into the public cloud and just boot from it. Right? That's actually a very real scenario with what we have in infrastructure as a service. Extend your DC, I mentioned, and your Windows licenses for things like Active Directory and SQL Server and SharePoint are going to work directly up in infrastructure as a service as well. So before I jump into my demo, I want to give you a quick kind of overview of what Distributed Transaction Coordinator is. Who's worked with the DTC? Show of hands. Show of hands. Who's had to troubleshoot some of it? And who loves it? Oh, you got it down too fast. I was supposed to catch you with your hands up. It's a bit of a complex thing to deal with. It's got some underlying stateful log files, and this is actually one of the reasons why it's not a supported thing inside of infrastructure or inside of platform as a service, our Windows Azure platform, because at any point in time, if your hardware goes kaplooey, we're going to pick it up and we're going to service heal you on another instance. You may be in the middle of a transaction at that point, which means the stateful log file that it's using to track your commit across multiple resource managers gets totally horked. So you can't, 99.9% of the time, I'm sure you're never going to have a problem, but we will not tell you that it's supported. We'll probably never say that it is. I mean, it's just, It's a difficult thing to ensure when we know there's an ongoing issue with hardware that can fail at any point in time, and will, honestly. Hardware will fail in these data centers. So that's one issue. Another one is it's Windows Integrated Office is pretty much how it's done. If you look at the DTC setups, and I'll show it in my demo, doing mutual authentication with Windows Auth with domain-joined machines is the norm. I mean, you can set it up to be open and anonymous. Not recommended, right? I would not set it up that way. So Windows Integrated is important. And while I've mentioned that it's a lot of legacy solutions depend on it, I haven't really troubleshot an app recently with it. Anything that uses system.transactions in .NET and coordinates two resource managers is going to actually hit this. So it's actually something that even with new styled applications, you have to understand and appreciate that DTC can be a dependency. It sort of goes on under the covers for you. You may not even be noticing it. But funny enough, I mean, one of our guidance for developers with platform as a service, even back from when we first started doing this, was to turn DTC off on your dev workstation. And that's because if it auto-escalated it to DTC, you wouldn't really notice it if you had it activated on your workstation, because some devs have maybe more access than they will have in production, right? It happens. I know I'm guilty of it. And then what you have to make sure to do is test it, and test it without the DTC, because it'll blow up once it gets to Windows Azure. All right, so now I'm gonna cover my demo here. I am 2, and I am probably locked out. I remember my password on the first try. So as I was pulling together a demo of DTC, I tried to think about how I could do this and not get bad evals by having a console world application or a console, you know, application that did cross commit to a foo database and a bar database. So I actually built a little inventory service UI using jQuery and MVC4 web API, and you'll be able to get access to all this code. It's already posted out in Blob Storage. And basically behind the scenes what it's going to do is as I make edits to things, I should change my password first of all. Of course, right? So behind the scenes, I'm going to make an update. Now, as I'm doing that, I'm going to go back here, and I'm going to connect to these actual machines. So let's take a look at what we've got. So I've got my domain controller. I went in and created a new Azure VM, and I actually did a DC promo on it up in the cloud. And then I collected the IP address, because the way you do this, if you're going to bring your own DC and do your own DNS resolution, is you've got to collect that IP address, because it is dynamically assigned initially. For the most part, people feel like when you're creating DNS servers and domain controllers, you use a lot of static IP addresses. And we do ensure that the IP addresses will remain static, but we do have to allocate it for you initially. You can set the subnet ranges, so you can control it to a degree, but you'll see I ended up with 192.168.1.4, right? 1, 2, and 3 aren't even being used, but that's what I ended up getting. So then I have the two DB servers, and I'm not going to go remote into those. And then I have my IIS box. So I'm going to start connecting to this guy. Full VPN access to the servers. And this will take a minute. Now while we're waiting, I want to show you the code, because the code isn't necessarily something that you maybe haven't seen before. It's just using system.transactions as a transaction scope wrapper right here. So using transaction scope, TS, transaction scope, and then inside of that you'll notice I've got product context, and master inventory context. So there's entity framework in here. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on entity framework, but it made my demo a lot easier because it writes all that ADO.NET code for me. And then underneath this, I'm just making updates across the two entity framework contexts, and I'm able to get the transaction to be escalated to DTC. So underneath that, the first thing you'll notice here is that I've got the transaction coordinator statistics up. I'm going to go ahead and minimize that guy. Resolution, hello. And let me show you this real quick. Open network and sharing center, local area connection, properties, TCP IPv4. And I had to go in and statically set that as who was actually resolving. And it might not be the easiest to see. Right, there's my 1.4 address, which is what was created, and I just IP config the domain controller to figure out what that was. And I'm effectively creating my own, you know, network up in the public cloud. I have it all self-contained, so I can domain join all those machines, and everything runs just like it does in your corporate data center. It's just like I I just created my own, right? So then coming back, let's go ahead and take a look at the transaction statistics. And you'll see that right now, we have 31 committed transactions. So let me go and do a couple more operations on here so you can see that we're actually hitting this thing. I'll actually, I'm going to go ahead and edit the Buffalo Bills helmet because this is going to be the Bills year. I'm from, anybody from Buffalo, New York? Nice. I got a guy. 12 years without a playoff berth. It's painful. So we're going to need 50 helmets. I went ahead and made that update. I'll go ahead and delete a couple of things. Edit this. Did everybody like my little rotating thing? That was a big find. All right, I got 34 DTC transactions that have flowed through this thing. And if I went in and showed you, I'll show you this real quick. I've had to enable, obviously, all the network inbound and outbound DTC transactions. But I'm not cheating. I am not using sort of a DTC Uber admin login account. I actually created on my domain. I actually created, and my domain is my developer tofu domain. I created a least privilege account. I set it up at the app pool level so that it's doing just enough security to run the DTC transaction across all of them. I easily could have just used the admin account as this is created, but this is just like setting it up in your own data center. You have all the right access to things, and this is preserved and persisted. It's not something we're going to go re-image on you and you're going to lose. Okay? All right, back to the slides. Okay, so I think hopefully through this first section of the talk, you got a good overview of the different paths in the cloud. I mean, I know we didn't go deep in some of the areas like private cloud computing, but really this is about infrastructure as a service versus platform as a service and hybrid and how all that works together. Hopefully you saw what IaaS can help you do in the cloud, right? Especially since you've got so much control at this point. Looked at these three application types. We just demoed one of them. You're going to see two more here coming up. And while this was good, we do feel like it can be better. And Purush is going to come up and talk about a pretty cool application that we've done that is definitely more in line with leveraging PaaS and IaaS together.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Purush Vankireddy. I'm Director of Service Engineering for MSDN TechNet Platform Operations Group at Microsoft. Tom talked about a lot of cool features of infrastructure service cloud offering and some of the tricks that you can use to migrate your server workloads into IaaS cloud offering. But what if you have a need to keep your application stack, some may be living in cloud, some may be living in an on-prem, and some may be in somewhere in between IaaS versus PaaS and on-prem. So my talk is I'm going to be sharing my real-time experience of how we leverage cloud and migrating MSDN TechNet platform into using the hybrid model of on-prem to PaaS, and then we are working on making some inroads into IaaS workloads, especially that is focused on SQL. Whatever I'm going to talk today is either mostly all in production, or we're going to have that in production pretty soon in the next couple of months. So before I get to the details of the actual implementation, let me start introducing our business as well as some of the complexities that we go through. I'll give you some context why it is worthwhile sharing that experience with all of you. Our team is called as Enterprise Platform Experience Group at Microsoft. We are responsible to provide help solutions for IT pros and developers for Microsoft products. These are all three flagship products that we offer, MSDN, TechNet, and MSDN subscriptions. I hope a majority of you already used some of this. How many people use this at least once in your lifetime of this site? So, and apart from these three flagship products, we also offer over 10 online services to help our IT pros and developers, something like blogs, forums, wikis, and a profile and that kind of stuff. So let's look at the scope of operations, what it takes to run this service. This may be the largest IT pro and developer destination for all Microsoft products in the world. we have over 50 million unique users that hits our services a month with over 300 million page views. And just on the reference manuals and how-tos, we have over 3 terabytes of content that we store in the database. If I add up all the galleries, forums, and all other services that we provide, that can easily go to up to 5 terabytes of content just on the content store itself. And in order to support this kind of scale, we use over 600 physical hosts across 4 data centers in North America to support this load. And like any other online service out there, we do about 30 releases a month. The reason why I'm sharing this data with you, this is not one of those small applications that we are thinking about moving, intranet, one or two people use our business application that we try to move to Azure. We are betting heavily on Azure, and we picked one of them is actually most critical and actually useful for a lot of audience here, which is developers and IT pros. I know you guys are very critical if something goes wrong with an MSD and TechNet, and so we know exactly what are kind of challenges that we go through and before we make this decision of taking on and moving that to Azure. Let's look at the commitments. Like any other online service in the industry, we also provide 3 nines of availability and under 3 seconds of performance. And just being at Microsoft, we always try to be on the cutting edge platforms. This is not only to help our businesses, but also to showcase our customers that we are serious about our products, as well as we use them before we tell our customers to use them. So we picked MSD and TechNet to kind of serve those both purposes. Not only it's helping, I'll go through a little bit more details on how it helped our business, but also hopefully it can relate to some of your experience that works for you, for your business. In terms of the priorities, cost efficiency is something that almost everybody, either CTO or if you can be an operations manager or operations director, everybody gets challenged to drive your costs down. We have to do lot more with less, and that's going to be ongoing. If you optimize the cost for this year, next year you're going to optimize a little bit more, and that's how it works. So we always look for something to optimize our costs, and the next one is the scale and agility. For the kind of scale that we talked about, agility and the scale is super important. And I'm going to go through a little bit of why it is important for this specific business that we are in the next slide. Why did we choose cloud? And how did it impact EPX, which is the group that I am part of? When it comes to making those decisions, as I was saying before, agility is one of the key important things for the business that we are part of. Microsoft ships many product launches every year, and we do something along with them. While we are doing the product launches, our capacity requirements goes up, and after a few weeks, it comes down. So we were looking for something that can give us that elasticity that Tom was talking about to manage our hardware and manage our service more efficiently. When it comes to the engineering investments, we didn't want to invest too much of engineering investments from the dev and test side, and we were looking for an option where we can take the existing code and just move them to cloud. So I'm going to show you how we are able to do that without making substantial changes from the engineering side. And also we were looking for something that we can quickly experiment and fail fast kind of environment where our migration path has to be simple enough so that we can do those experiments. Number two, when it comes to hosting, efficient provisioning is something that for people who is responsible to procure hardware or manage our infrastructure, for some companies it can be a 3 month process, or some companies it can be an yearly planning, and definitely it's not going to be on demand. So we are looking for something that can provide us that on demand capabilities to provision the hardware when we need them, where we need them, to scale to what we are looking for. Number two, because of the fact that we are building our capacity for the peak, our overall utilization was around anywhere between 25%. And with the dynamic elasticity, we are hoping to get that to about 50% utilization overall. Cost is another one, which is, as I was saying, it's, we always look for to optimize our overall cost. That is one of the things that, so our target was about 20% overall cost reductions, just on the infrastructure side. In terms of when it comes to manageability, for any online service to be successful, we have to think about how we are going to make those shifts from completely on-prem solution to a combination of on-prem to cloud models. We have to make sure our deployment processes, our monitoring, our reporting, and all the asset management, all of those things too has to be put together as part of our overall process. And also look for an opportunity to reduce the amount of time it takes to manage them in terms of the labor. And we obviously want to use the dynamic scaling to go back to my previous point of the launch readiness and as well as the some of the challenges that we have in provisioning the hardware. So those are the kind of decisions that went through to before we make a decision on choosing Azure as part of our platform to move our databases there. In terms of the goals, before we started to put together this plan, we established a few goals. Number one, we didn't want to make any architectural changes or code changes. That means we moved everything, whatever we have on-prem, into Azure without writing within a single line of code. The manageability and operability is super important, and we have to make sure we, whatever process that we have in on-prem, that has to work in a hybrid model, where our deployment process, our monitoring, our reporting, all of them has to plug in. The third one is the performance. As I was saying, online services these days measured by what is the performance, and it's directly related to the overall revenue that they measure with. And it has to be same as on-prem or even better, which is under 3 seconds. Four, we want to leverage that dynamic scaling and geo-redundancy that Azure offers, but at the same time, the way we acquire the content and push the content, we didn't want to introduce latencies and the publishing times. So all of these things has to be worked together before we can complete that Azure migration overall. So those are the goals that we established. Now I'm going to get down to the actual details of how we did it. As you can see, this is pretty straightforward, a two-tier architecture where we have a web front-end, web servers connected to the back-end databases. Starting from the bottommost left, where we have publishing tools and build services get connected to a publisher, that in turn get the data get replicated to SQL servers across multiple data centers. And that in turn have the our web servers, which has been already virtualized as part of the VMs, and it's stateless. So what we did as a first part of the first migration, we took those web VMs, moved them as a web roles in Azure Cloud using PaaS, and established the backend connectivity to SQL backend, which is on-prem. If you hit MSDN or TechNet today, there is a 50% chance you may be hitting this architecture. There's a 50% chance that probably you're hitting one of our Azure instances or maybe one of the on-prem. That's how the traffic has been load balanced, and that's how the traffic we are managing as it stands today. But we all know that most of the workload is in the database right now, and the connectivity is another one which we need to worry about. So as of last week, with the persistent VM role, we are moving that database into as a PaaS, IaaS VM role with the database installed without that all that 4 terabytes of content that I was talking about. And establish a SQL replication from our publishing database to a VM role that is hosting this database. This is currently in a pilot, which I'm going to showcase as part of my demo. But if this all works through, if that meets our requirements of performance, which I have high confidence, I'm going to showcase some of that performance numbers also. We're going to burst it out all the way and slowly migrate everything into a PaaS and IaaS combination of all our publishing tools, database, as well as web roles running in Azure Cloud. This is what our real-time experience, and we are almost there. About 75% of the work is done, and we are working on completing that IaaS database to mature that and take that into life. With that, I will have a small demo that I'm going to log into. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to RDP into the SQL Server that is hosted in IaaS VMworld and show some of the database properties. So, you know, now we are connecting into the actual SQL Server that's hosting that the big database that I was talking about. It is running in a VM role. As I was saying, all the things that I'm showing, it's nothing. We didn't build anything for this specific to this demo. This is part of our pilot, and this is exactly what I'm going to show. Let's open up the Management Studio and connect to that SQL Server. As you can see, there are three databases listed here. Those are all primary, principal, and we have another server, database server, that is MSDN SQL 3. As you can see, these ones are mirrored. This is for the high availability solution. If one goes offline, we can bring the other one online. And just run some few database queries so that this is one of the largest queue that you can get in a VM role, which has 8 proc and 14 gigs memory. This is the probably, and it can hold about 16 terabytes of data with each disk has about terabyte, and you can attach about 16 of them. This is one of the largest ones. The minimum one, the smallest possible one, I think, you can go up to 1 terabyte and 1 gig memory with one processor. In terms of the drives, so we have a bunch of drives that we attach to this SQL VM, and we split our data across a bunch of drive letters. And we can go, technically, we can go all the way up to 16 terabytes if we need to be. So with that, let me actually hit the site. So this is a web role actually connected to the SQL database that I was talking about. As you can see, this is not optimized at all. We just took the code, we just plugged it in the web role. And the database also, we haven't tuned anything. It is just sitting in a SQL VM role, and this is kind of in a pilot state. With that, let me shut down SQL. John, I'm going to bring TechNet down for some time.
The whole world is going to.
So let's hit this. So it failed. So let's go back. Anyway, just kidding. This is a test server, a test cluster anyway. It's not hitting the production. Yes. And So I just want to showcase the actual implementation of how we did it. And this all looks good, but let me share the initial performance numbers here. Performance numbers of what we did with the, so as you can see these red bars, there's a combination of a web role connected to non-prem SQL. Those SQL boxes are beefy. It has about 64 gigs of memory with about 4 to 5 terabytes of disk space, and it's a very beefy SQL servers. On the one which is on the to the right, which is the yellow boxes, those are all an IaaS VM role. IaaS VM role connected to PaaS web role. That's a combination. As you can see, it's pretty close in terms of overall performance on the site. But again, this is without having any tuning. Nothing has been done. We just took the plain simple code, migrated them to web role and IaaS SQL server. So we're still investigating why TechNet Exchange server, for example, has more PLTs than the other ones are. But I'm very confident this can be easily tuned and tweaked to get to run our SQL databases in IaaS VM role. With that, let me quickly summarize. All of the things that I just talked about, we were able to complete that in about 3 months with the help of PFE engineering, with the Greg's team, as well as some of the folks from my team. And we were able to add about 80 instances for Win8 beta in less than a few hours, which used to take a couple of weeks to complete the same task. And the deployment and monitoring, all the processes that we have with a little bit of tweaks here and there in terms of the overall process, we're able to reuse most of that for the cloud offering as well. In terms of the learning curve, it was actually a lot smaller than what we anticipated, where we thought it's going to be a huge change and it's going to be, we may have to write a bunch of code. We haven't written any line of code just from the application stack, but from the service engineering, in terms of the monitoring, in terms of the reporting and all of that, we'll have to add some more code to get those data. Connectivity is definitely one of the things that we suggested. It's very critical. You'll have to decide what works for best, what do you want to keep it in on-prem, what do you want to keep it in cloud, and depending on your maturity of your application stack, you'll have to decide what's best. This was great, but can it be any better? I'm going to have Greg to come in and talk about PaaS and what are the capabilities that PaaS can provide.
Thank you, Purush. Can anyone hear me okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah? All right, cool. So let's talk about the end state. Tom has shown us a lot of the wonderful stuff where you can forklift your VMs directly into Azure. Purush took it a step further and really separated it out, showing SQL Server running inside of a persisted VM right in the cloud, and then actually having your websites running inside of that, inside of a PaaS web role, all right? Which that, of course, enables big scale-out potential. I'm going to talk more about, okay, so let's say we want to move directly into platform as a service, and what does something like that look like? I often get the question, how difficult is it to migrate my application or move my application into platform as a service? Well, as everyone hates it when I reply with, it depends, right? So, wow, that was a weird transition. All right. just seemed to jump there. All right, anyway, it depends. If you have a simple application, something that is stateless by design, you're not using session state or anything like that, you're not using DTC, you're not using MSMQ, you're not any platform constraints, you don't have a massive database on the size of, you know, 4 or 6 or 8 terabytes, you know, something along those lines, which would inhibit you from potentially going to something like SQL Azure, you know, all of those things, it's going to make it very, very simple to migrate. However, if you have a more complex application where you have a lot of data access which doesn't have any resiliency built in, or you're storing a lot of stuff in session state or, you know, your server cache or something along those lines, all those aren't bad things, by the way. I want to certainly say that. But it may make the path a little bit more, or a little bit lengthier than just shoving it up there. If you have any environment or configuration which is highly specialized, or perhaps most importantly, you don't know how your application is really behaving in production. I talk to customers all day long, and a lot of times they can't tell me what their peak load time is. That's something that's going to be very, very important if you really want to use the cloud to its fullest. So to show this off, we'll start with this little expense report application. As you can see here, it's fairly basic, two tiers. You have a web tier, you have a database tier. Both of those are fantastic, and what this enables is the user can go onto this website, create an expense report, and even attach their receipts to the expense report. The application, then when you click submit, it will then resize the image down to something a little bit more manageable and store it inside of the database. Everything is done inside of the web tier. This by itself, if you want to keep the same general application architecture, you can do so no problems. However, Azure and PaaS in particular allows you to shake things up a little bit. What you can do is you can take the web server the way that it is now and just essentially have it serve up just your web pages and just your typical application resources. However, within PaaS, you can actually have the code that does the image resizing. You can have that in a separate worker role, queued up, so then the application sends an entry to the queue, and then you have your image resizer worker role, essentially, that is going through and processing the items within the queue. This allows your web application and the actual image resizing operation to scale independently, which is a really compelling prospect if you think about it. Furthermore, instead of storing all of these images and things like that inside of a blob field inside of a database, you can actually put it into Azure Blob Storage. The cool thing about that is that the actual per item cost of each item you place in Blob Storage actually decreases the more you put into it, the more you use it, because of our graduated pricing model. So we showed you the application architecture, what it could look like in Azure. Now let's do the cost-benefit analysis. Is it really worth it to move this application? Well, from an agility standpoint, I want to be agile. So the first question I'm going to ask is, what is my usage pattern? Who waits until the end of the month to file their expense reports? Yeah, a lot of hands up there. Yeah, who never files an expense report? Oh, okay, nobody there. Good. So because of that, we see that about 60 to 70% of people typically will wait until the end of the month to file their expense report. So as a result, we need to be able to handle that load, but during the off times of the month, we don't want to necessarily have all these servers sitting there vacant, sitting there not really doing anything. So we want to be able to scale out at the end of the month so we can handle all of those additional requests, but then scale back in the beginning of the month. Furthermore, we don't necessarily want to deal with the OS patching, especially if we're going to be going out with this scale out model and scale back in model. We're going to be bringing new instances back online all the time. We don't necessarily care, and we don't necessarily want to be patching those servers, making sure that they're all up and running all the time. Lastly, unlike Tom's application and Tom's company, which only has offices and work and storefronts within the US, I have a global workforce, all right? I have global customers for my application, people all over the world, and I want to enable the scenario in which I can put a copy of my application all over the world, and so they don't have to deal with the latency. From a cost perspective, oftentimes we have to make sure that we store our receipts and store a lot of this financial information for 7 years or so. So we need to make sure that we have something inside of our blob storage to account for that. Or we have to make sure that we have a scenario or the capabilities to store increasingly larger and larger files over time. Furthermore, because we're going to be expanding out and scaling back in, I don't want to deal with my enterprise license agreement. I don't want to even deal with the licenses and making sure that my application is going to be up all the time. Fortunately, with Azure, if something fails, I can easily go down, rather Azure, if something fails in that data center, they'll easily just shift me over to another node within that data center, and it'll be a snap just to bring it back online. Plus, DR, disaster recovery, is built right into the platform. Enough said there, right? So now that we've decided we have a pretty compelling case, let's put this application into the cloud. There are three areas that you really need to look at. The first one is environment, then code, and then what your runtime looks like. From an environment perspective, you need to look at two things on the server. If you have any GACT assemblies, you need to make sure that you deploy those GACT assemblies as well as any of your COM objects with your application. People like to think that COM is going away. Well, fact of the matter is it's been around for a while. You can still run it inside of PaaS. You just need to make sure that you deploy it with your application. If you've made any customizations to your website configuration or your application pool configuration, or you have any custom ISAPI filters or HTTP modules, things for authentication and authorization, stuff like that, you need to make sure that you deploy them, or at least look at those types of additional dependencies you may not be aware of. Fortunately, if you need to actually push this out into the cloud, you can set up a startup script or an application or an executable, something to do that will run on start for the application itself. Lastly, I include Windows authentication here because up until last Thursday, when we made this thing publicly available, your only option if you had an application that was using Windows authentication was to move to more of a federated model. Fortunately, now with infrastructure as a service, what you can actually do is you can throw a DC right into a VM in the cloud and actually join your PaaS server to that DC in the cloud. So that enables your application to use Windows authentication the same way it did on-premise, for instance. From a code perspective, most of your code will remain unchanged. Your business logic is still your business logic. Except, there are some things. So for example, if you maintain state inside of the registry, happens all the time, if you write a lot of files to disk that you know you'll need to access later, you need to keep in mind that PaaS servers or PaaS VMs don't come with a persistent file system. Because of that, anytime your application gets reimaged down the line, you'll need to actually store those files or things that your application depends on, either inside of a cloud drive or throw it into blob storage. If you store a lot of things into session state, once again, not necessarily a bad thing. You just need to make sure that you are actually persisting whatever you store into session state off of the web server itself. There's no such thing as sticky session or single affinity inside of a PaaS VM. Meaning that the user will go from one server to another server to another server within your little web farm. If you have a lot of data access code which doesn't have any resiliency built in, and we'll talk more about this in just a second, you may need to look at refactoring it just a teeny bit. And lastly, from a dependency perspective, if your application relies upon some INI files, it might be time to actually look at another way of storing that configuration, move into the 2000s, right? But from a nuts and bolts perspective, if your application uses INI files, likely you're making some pinvoke calls. Those will generally be okay, but we would still recommend you move to a more modern configuration system. Last but not least, hardcore networking. If your application and your servers on premise have multiple NICs and your application depends upon that, you may need to look at refactoring some of that code. So what you see here is the standard, what we call try-catch-retry pattern. All right. So this is used primarily when you interact with SQL Azure. As we know, SQL Azure, or as it's called now, Windows Azure SQL Database? Yeah, I'm going to call it SQL Azure for now. All right. it is a multi-tenant database platform, meaning you are essentially sharing the database platform with other people. Right. As a result of that, we need to be a little bit aggressive in the way that we do some of these throttling work. All right. As a result, we need to build a little bit of resiliency into our data access code so that we make sure that people can, that if SQL Azure tells us to try again, we can actually try again. Fortunately, our friends on the Patterns and Practices team, they developed an application block available on their website, which can do a lot of this work for you. You can just call out to it, and it will handle all of this type of, you know, retry logic for you. Lastly, we have the runtime scenario. Now, I say on-premise does not equal the Windows Azure environment. What that means is that you really need to, this final stage of an application migration up to PaaS generally includes four steps. You need to understand the load for your application, look at areas to optimize the application, not necessarily optimize the code, but optimize the way that your application is potentially performing, which is not always the code. We'll talk about that in a second. Compare your on-premise VMs and your actual resource utilization to what Azure provides from a VM size perspective and make a correct, educated decision. And last but not least, deploy, test, and repeat. I'll let him take his picture. All right, moving on. All right, so from an understanding the load perspective, what you want to do is you want to look at the IIS logs. You know, these little gems will tell you how many requests your application is getting, how fast it's able to respond. So this is going to be invaluable when it comes to identifying when your peak load time is. So if you have an expense report application, that last week of the month is going to be fair game. Many people, their peak load time is from 9 to 5, for instance. Something to keep in mind. These other two charts here, the server CPU and the IIS CPU, we found that a lot of folks in the enterprise, or even not in the enterprise, they have a lot of background services and background processes that have just always been installed in their production server images. Surprise, surprise, a lot of that stuff takes up CPU, right? So a lot of people, when they look at migrating to Azure, they look at the scenario in which, all right, well, my server is using 80 or 90% CPU. That must mean that I need to move things over to at that same level. Not necessarily true. As you can see here in this chart, we have a server that is using 90% CPU. It's got a lot of background stuff going on, maybe background virus scanners and things like that. But the actual IIS CPU, meaning the W3WP process itself, is using less than 1%. This is obviously an extreme case, but it's also very, very common. So you definitely want to be looking more at your W3WP CPU, as that's going to be more representative of how your application is really performing inside of a production type environment. When it comes to the optimization side of things, and websites in particular, you want to look at how your application is actually returning these HTTP status codes. 302s and 304s and 404s, they generally represent unnecessary additional requests that are being made, which can artificially inflate your CPU. The big offender, though, is going to be the HTTP 500s. I'm going to go out on a limb here and tell you that exceptions and errors are expensive. All right? I don't think that's going to shock anybody, right? So errors and exceptions are, in fact, very expensive, and they can artificially inflate the amount of processor utilization you see within your application. As a result of that, you know, if you have a lot of exceptions that are being thrown, your CPU may skyrocket, and that may make you think that, hey, we need to either scale up or scale out to handle these additional requests. So definitely take a look at that. From a background worker role perspective, or something that is like a console application, think of the background worker roles as console apps. If you have an unhandled exception, Azure is going to think it's unhealthy, and it will restart the process, or it will, you know, reinitialize the worker role. Also, in order to make sure that you use the CPU on these worker roles, since you're essentially getting a VM, an entire VM just for these worker roles, you want to make sure that you are doing as much asynchronous work as possible so that you can fully utilize the resources available to you on these VMs. Lastly, you want to make sure that if you're storing a lot of logs and data within table storage or blob storage or anything along those lines, you want to make sure you're purging it because, well, guess what? You're paying for it, right? You want to be as efficient as humanly possible. So we've mentioned a couple of things here that you need to be aware of. Well, more than a couple maybe, right? But fortunately, there are a couple of tools available. On the SQL Azure side of things, there's a SQL Azure Migration Wizard developed by our friend George Huey in DPE. And that's available out on CodePlex today. You can go off, you can download it, and it will analyze your database code, your tables, your stored procedures, your views, and it will tell you if there are any incompatibilities with SQL Azure. There's also the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit for Windows Azure Platform. We'll just call it the MAP Toolkit, okay? This is a great tool that really will help you guys inventory your applications that you have on premise, help you figure out the TCO and the return on the potential return on the investment, and plan for the migration. This is also available on our Microsoft.com website for download. But as you can see here, I showed you a couple of things when it comes to the website configuration, the application pool configuration, your .NET code, things like that that none of these tools really, really look at. Well, guess what? There's an app for that. My team has been developing this for a bit now. It's called the Windows Azure Migration Assessment. It will actually discover your complete application environment, analyze your .NET code, analyze your SQL code, analyze your entire environment, and essentially spit out a to-do list of everything you need to be aware of when you migrate your application to Windows Azure, and specifically to PaaS. Everything from SQL to .NET to your website configuration, the whole ball of wax. You guys want to see that? You want to check it out? All right, let's do it. Tom, can you hit number 3, please? All right. All right, you guys can see my mouse, right? So here's our tool. It is, we're about to enter into the beta here, but it starts off, you've got our wonderful dashboard here, tells you a little bit about it. We can then discover the application itself. You can see here, I have our expense report application. And then furthermore, we can also discover all of the databases that I have installed here. I don't think I have anything confidential, do I? No?
Too late now.
Yeah, too late now. But we can select down to the specific database that we actually care about. You know, for in this case, the AExpense database. Then from a collection side of things, we will then collect a ton of data around your application and the environment. Everything from the contents of your GAC on your on-premise servers, which we then can compare to what an Azure VM has in its GAC by default. We'll kick out a list for you and tell you, okay, these are the ones that you need to make sure you register when you migrate over. On the ASP.NET side of things, we'll capture all of your application code. On the Azure side, your SQL scripts, and if you have any linked SQL servers on-premise, this is actually a very important one. That unfortunately is not supported right now in SQL Azure. And so on and so forth. Once we've captured that information, we can visualize it, and you can see here we've got a full list of all the GAC DLLs. That may not be so cool, but if we come down here and we look at the actual code analysis results, we can tell you. So here, for example, is that implement the try-catch-retry pattern. Remember that one, the one I just showed you a second ago? We actually detect where you are not doing it. So if you have an application with hundreds of thousands of lines of code, this is going to be very, very useful to pick out the exact areas of your code that you need to modify in order to do this migration over to PaaS. So we have some wonderful guidance here. By the way, our friends in the Patterns and Practices team actually wrote all this guidance for us. So thank you, guys. If you're out there somewhere in TV land, all right. But then once we go through all of this stuff, we tell you eventually, there's a lot of guidance on this particular one, but we'll tell you exactly where, down to the statement level, where you are doing some data access that doesn't have a try, catch, retry around it. So that's pretty cool, right? So we're just entering the beta for this. I have some business cards up here. If you'd like to be a part of the beta, come up here, grab a business card at the conclusion of the session, shoot me an email, and I will get you on the list. Let's flip back to the presentation, Tom, please. So we have some related content for our session here. We're trying to leave you guys some time to ask questions, so don't immediately take off, all right? Yeah, somebody lock the doors, yeah. Tom's inventory service source code is available. Just click on the link. It is outstanding, filled with a lot of jQuery awesomeness. The MSDN TechNet white papers and case study, which describe a lot of the details around our migrations, are available here as well. Definitely check out immediately following this session is another session on migrating applications, specifically focusing on the IaaS piece of it, I believe. And then there was another session that was done yesterday. Yeah, AZR 201. Where is AZR 314, Tom?
Upstairs, 330E.
So definitely check that out. You can find Tom at developertofu.com, or you can tweet him. Follow them, tweet them, at developertofu. Me, I'm at samuraiprogrammer.com, so you have developertofu and samuraiprogrammer. Check us out. You can tweet me at barbaris. So, in summary, the cloud is good. No. In summary, Tom started us off with a great talk about infrastructure as a service and the ability to forklift your applications directly into the cloud. Very compelling. Prush took it a step further, as I mentioned earlier, by showing us a SQL server that's been forklifted in there and some of the great performance metrics that we've been able to see with that. And then moving and setting up your websites so that they can be dynamically scaled out independently of your SQL server. So that can handle additional traffic without having to make a change on your SQL side of things. I ended things with what I think is the best scenario. Which is migrating an application and moving it directly into platform as a service. Well, you have all the pieces available to you. The time is now. Go forth and migrate. Thank you. The end. We have some track resources, additional resources. Complete an evaluation, grab our tag, and evaluate it.